Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Did you get enough sleep last night? According to the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, 40 to 50 million American adults sleep 6 or fewer hours a night. In other words, we're sleep deprived. Sleep disorders have negative impacts on our work performance, personal relationships, and overall well-being. And a lot of people are harder hit, like those working the night shifts or in the transportation, warehouse, and healthcare industries. We've got 70 different sleep disorders on the books, and urban environments full of artificial lights, noises, stimulants, digital screens, and stressors of all kinds. Now, most of us know we need more sleep. So what steps can we take to get the recommended 7 to 9 hours at regular times each night? On today's Your Call, we are talking about the importance of sleep. What exactly is the significance of sleep for our mental and physical health? How much sleep do we need? And how can we create a more sleep-friendly society? Is sleep deprivation becoming a public health issue? Dr. Michael Twery is director of the National Center on Sleep Disorders Research at the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Twery studies the link between sleep disorders and short sleep duration with cardiovascular disease risk factors such as diabetes and obesity. And he joins us from Bethesda, Maryland. Hi, Dr. Twery. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Rose. Delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Kimberly Trotter, Administrative Director at the UC San Francisco Sleep Disorder Center. She's also core faculty member of the School of Sleep Medicine and is on the board of the California Sleep Society. Kim is a registered sleep technologist with 28 years of experience in the field of sleep health. She specializes in sleep apnea, sleep hygiene, and the connection between sleep and our health. And she joins us from her office in San Francisco. Hi, Kimberly. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Happy to be here.
It's great to have you. So, Dr. Twery, how much sleep did you get last night?
Not enough.
like 6 hours?
Yeah, probably about 6 hours. Like many people, we all have busy schedules, we have obligations, and we have to balance those needs with the rest of the demands on our body. But, you know, we feel it. I think everyone recognizes when they haven't gotten enough sleep, it shows up as sleepiness, but it also shows up as changes in our mood. It changes the way we see the world around us, and probably many of us have experienced that as well.
It seems like most people say they get about 6 hours. That's sort of become the new norm. Is that what you found in your research?
Yeah, so we find that, yes, a large portion of people in the United States, and this is the data that you mentioned at the opening, from the CDC health surveillance data, where the CDC is able to survey large numbers of people across the country and ask them, you know, are they getting enough sleep or rest? And actually, it's very nice that, you know, in the San Francisco area, the latest available data suggests that perhaps 20 to 25% of adults in the San Francisco area report not getting enough rest or sleep.
Hmm. And Kimberly, what about you? How much sleep did you get last night?
Well, I'm happy to report about 8.5 hours.
Oh, congratulations. Why is it? I mean, I get about 6 hours. I know that's not enough. Why is it that even though we know it's not enough and we might not feel good by Thursday or Friday, we still don't take the initiative to get more sleep?
So if I may, I think research is starting to shed some light on this, and that is that we have competing schedules, but sleep, unlike some of the other factors that affect our health, is a relatively hidden factor. It's hard to understand how not getting enough sleep is compromising our ability to perform during the day, and it's even more difficult to understand how it's affecting our health. You don't feel pain mm-hmm. Inside our body when we don't get enough sleep. It changes the pattern of hormones. It changes our metabolism. It changes many physiological processes. but it's not something that, you know, is acutely painful. It's, I often compare it to what happens when, you know, in the old days when we when a car engine needed a tune-up, spark plugs in those days had to fire at the exact right moment as the engine turned, and if the timing of the spark plug was off a little bit, it produced incomplete combustion, the metabolism of the engine was poor, fuel performance was poor, it produced a lot of soot and carbon that clogged the engine, but the engine would keep running even if it was slightly out of tune. and so I use this analogy because it doesn't, you know, just as in the case of a car engine, we don't feel the problem necessarily until it's really bad and we notice that, you know, gee, we're just losing power here.
Yeah, it's a great analogy. Kim, what would you add to that? Why is this so important? We did a show last week about cancer prevention, and one of the doctors on the show, Dr. Gabriella Heinzheimer, said, there are many things we can do to try to prevent cancer, including eating a lot of fruits and vegetables, reducing our stress, and getting a lot of sleep.
Well, like Dr. Twery was saying, basically with people that are sleep depriving themselves, whether it's an intentional occurrence or not, the feeling of the sleep deprivation, it happens over a slow period of time, and so you just get used to running on those 6 or 7 hours of sleep. It's just something you get used to. And, you know, with Starbucks around and with the five-hour energy drinks, you've got all of these other crutches that you can use to keep yourself going during the day. As far as, you know, why it's so important, again, Dr. Twery, I'm so glad that you're on the program. Basically, there's so many hormonal changes that happen, and you know, there are ways that we can try and get a better night's sleep and get more sleep. Just, you know, cutting things out in the early evenings. Most people have to get up at the same time each morning to go to work, so you can't really say, well, I'm just going to sleep in another hour or two. But you can try and figure out ways, you know, make sleep a very important thing to do. You know, take a look at, you know, is there any time that you can spend trying to get a better night's sleep, getting to bed earlier in the evening rather than, you know, checking those last few emails or going on to the computer and, you know, taking a look at you know, late night TV and things like that. It's just, you have to take a look at priorities and make sleep more of a priority.
So let me add to that, Rose, because, you know, research is, in with respect to the cancer and this health thing, you know, what research is starting to show is that we have clocks. We have this biological clock, the same clock that is responsible for how we go through cycles of sleep and wakefulness, and it drives that part of our health. But these same genetic program is running in almost every cell of our body. It's part of the biology of the heart muscle. It's part of the biology of the lung. It's part of the liver. And why it, what it contributes is it helps organize that the metabolism of these cells. And when, just like in with the engine where it's misfiring or it's not, the timing of the spark plugs is incorrect, it produces inefficiencies in that metabolism, and that can lead to damage to cells, and it can impair the ability of the cells, the natural ability to repair themselves, to repair our DNA. It can impair those functions. And over the course of time, and by time here we're talking, you know, these are, you know, it may take years, but over the course of time, this can erode our health and lead to conditions. As you said, it increases your risk of cancer in some situations. It can affect our it can be a stressor that can lead to insulin resistance and the development of diabetes. We've also seen relationships with hypertension and stroke.
And isn't it true that we can't make it up? A lot of us think, well, maybe I'll get 5 or 6 hours, but I'll just take a nap and everything will be fine.
Yeah, so this is, I think this is a source of a part of the confusion that Kim was mentioning, and that is, you know, the amount of sleep and the type of sleep that can serve our executive thinking, the ability of our brain to make decisions and so forth, is somewhat different than the type of sleep and the amount of sleep that's necessary to that best serves our physical health. All these these biological rhythms running throughout our body. And so research indicates that perhaps a 2 to 3 hours or even a short nap in the afternoon, we can all experience this, is very refreshing. We can think more clearly and so forth. Those short periods of sleep taken throughout the day do not serve the need to maintain these overall pattern of rhythm that drives our physical health. That requires that, and for adults, 7 to 8 hours of sleep. And it's important to sleep at the right, basically at the time that our body wants to sleep, which is usually in the evening for just about everyone. It's important to sleep the right duration, 7 to 8 hours, and it's important to have good quality sleep.
And Kim, what would you say, is 7 to 8 hours adequate? And how do you determine what your body needs? Because you often hear from people who say, well, I don't need that much sleep, or I can't get more than 6 hours of sleep. My body just automatically wakes up.
And there are those lucky few that only require 6 hours of sleep, 5 or 6 hours. And, you know, how you can tell if you need fewer hours of sleep is, how do you feel during the day? Mm-hmm. Are you completely rested? Do you have a sense of well-being throughout the entire day, even in the late afternoon? Or do you feel like your productivity is, lessening, or you're losing concentration? Those are the types of things that I tell patients, you know, when they come to me and say, hey, I'm only getting 5 or 6 hours of sleep. Is that appropriate? To tell if you're sleep depriving yourself, what is the difference between how many hours of sleep you get on a weeknight versus a weekend? Do you feel like you're catching up on sleep every single weekend? If so, then that's an indicator that you're probably not getting enough sleep during the week. And their research has shown that as little as 3 or 4 nights of less than 1 hour of sleep per night than your body requires is equivalent to not sleeping for an entire night.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's huge. And does that change with age?
Well, actually, you know, that's a misnomer. A lot of people think that as you get older, you require less sleep, when in actuality, older folks still need the same amount of sleep. They're just not able to get it because of medications they may be on or chronic pain. Their sleep cycles have a tendency to kind of dissipate a little bit because they're not having to get up at the same time every morning to go to work. So perhaps they're waking up really early, and then maybe they're going to take a nap. We're also seeing a difference in their actual sleep cycles. The elderly have a tendency to be sleepy a lot earlier in the evening, around 8:30 or 9 p.m., and then wake up around 3 or 4 in the morning. Then they take a nap during the day. So if you count the 24-hour period of time, they might actually still be getting maybe 6 or 7 hours of sleep. But as Dr. Turi mentioned, you know, getting sleep, you know, in little bits and pieces throughout a 24-hour period is not going to help your body out as much as getting a full night's sleep at the right period of time.
We have a question about this from Robert. He says, can you estimate what percentage of pharmaceutical sales are related to sleep disorders? Dr. Twary, do you have that info?
So I'm very familiar with the research, but pharmaceutical sales is a little bit outside of my scope. I think that we can all look around, our grocery stores or wherever we go, and there's many, many products available in terms of over-the-counter products. The people want to live their lives to the fullest. They want to be awake. They want to be vigorous. We know that people are not getting enough sleep. They report large part of the population, you know, perhaps in the, you know, 20 to 25% of the population reports not getting enough sleep, and they're looking for answers. And this is all, you know, pharmaceuticals represent perhaps part, you know, one of the many tools that physicians have available to help people who aren't getting enough sleep. But, you know, the pharmacotherapeutics, the drugs that are available, are just one part of the whole treatment picture. But how much and things, I think, is a little bit outside the scope of how sleep relates to health.
And Kim, do you have anything to add to that?
Not particularly. Just to note that the sleeping medications that are out there really are only meant to be taken on a temporary basis and not to be taken for years and years at a time. Oftentimes what will happen is the sleeping medications will lose their effectiveness, and then you either have to increase the dosage or change the medication, and that just, you know, is down a kind of a downward spiral as far as staying on medications for sleep. And I know that many sleep physicians will take a look at behavioral ways to help people get a better night's sleep, as well as medications to just break the cycle, but not to be taken for years and years at a time.
And the FDA issued a warning for prescription sleep drugs in March 2007, telling patients that they can cause rare allergic reactions and complex sleep-related behaviors, including sleep driving. And we have a link to that at yourcallradio.org. What is sleep driving, Dr. Twery?
Well, you know, there's many side effects for most all drugs. I mean, it's what people experience can vary, but you know, there is a phenomenon, and it doesn't occur in everyone, and it doesn't occur equally. That's why we always, you know, folks who feel that sleep is a problem for them or that sleepiness is a burden to their daily activities, we always encourage them to go to their physician who is in the, you know, their personal doctor who can understand their symptoms in the context of their bigger health pictures. But for those people who receive certain types of hypnotic drugs, there can be a situation which is, I guess, easily described as automatic behavior. It's perhaps not entirely unlike a drug-induced sleepwalking. But, you know, again, this is something, you know, whether someone should consider and how to use hypnotic drugs or other agents as just to assist them to get back into sleeping the right amount of time, the right amount each night, at the right time each night, and having good quality sleep. This is just part of one of the many tools that their physicians will use. And it's something that the risk and the downsides are something that a patient needs to discuss, with their physician as to whether that's appropriate.
Well, they sure are selling, because total drug revenues in the sleep disorders market exceeded about $7 billion in 2008. And today we are talking about the importance of sleep. Most of us don't get enough. According to the CDC, 40 to 50 million American adults sleep 6 or fewer hours a day. And we'd love to hear from you. What is your relationship with sleep? Do you get enough? How much do you need? If you've figured out how to have a healthy sleep routine, please share it with us. Most of us know what we need to do, but for some reason, we just don't go to bed when we should. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you work the night shift, we'll also be talking about that, because if you work the night shift, you've got a whole other set of issues to deal with. And how do you think we can make our culture more sleep friendly? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Dr. Michael Twery, Director of the National Center on Sleep Disorders Research at the National Institutes of Health, and Kimberly Trotter is the Administrative Director of the UC San Francisco Sleep Disorders Center. And let's hear from Andrea in Santa Cruz. Hi, Andrea. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Nice to hear you once again. Anyway, you've heard me call in before, and I'm disabled. I'm 45 years old, and I've been disabled. I became disabled when I was like 33, and I've been diagnosed with osteoarthritis and fibromyalgia. But recently, this last April, I've got diagnosed with blood loss induced anemia. And so it feels like a double whammy, because there's a lot of, you know, chronic fatigue, also with chronic pain from fibromyalgia. And, you know, I'm staying here at the Poly Loft shelter in Santa Cruz. And even those of us that are disabled, this has been a big issue here. I've had to seek an advocate, because we have to wake up. We get woken up at 6 o'clock every morning. We have to be out at 7. There's nothing to do. There's nowhere to go. And we can't even go back up and lay down, until like 4:30, 5 o'clock in the evening. And we've tried to get an advocate to make accommodation requests for them to make a safe place for handicapped people to lay down during the daytime, and they just can't do it. Mm. And so, like, all the time, you know, day in and day out, I'm like so fatigued, you know, I'm just like in various places, sitting on my walker and having to lay my head down on my arm. But then a lot of times in the evening times, for when everyone's lying down to go to sleep at night, for some reason, I can't seem to fall asleep. So I have to take prescription drugs to help me try to get to sleep at night. But then I just can't stay awake during the daytime. And it's just killing me, and it's getting me more depressed. And I just don't know what to do about it except try to hang in there and, hang in there and let my advocate, do what he needs to do to help us get some justice.
Gosh, Andrea, you're bringing up a whole set of new issues. I'm working on a story right now about older homeless women in San Francisco, and I'm hearing the same thing, that it's really hard to get sleep in the shelters because you've got so many people around you. People are making noise. You might be frightened for some reason. And in San Francisco, I know that one church in the Tenderloin allows people to sleep in the pews during the days because, like you said, it's really hard for people like yourself to get sleep. Dr. Twery, is there much research looking into this? And what are your thoughts about what Andrea said? I mean, I've been meeting so many women and men who express similar sentiments.
Well, the research suggests that not getting enough sleep and rest, is a problem. I mean, the situation perhaps where research is just starting to bring our understanding of this connection between sleep and health, and that includes immunological health, metabolic health, and so forth, is in the critical care facilities of hospitals, for instance. So, folks who are very sick, they're being constantly attended to. They're under perhaps working light conditions, and it can be very difficult for them to get enough sleep. This is a problem for seriously ill people in almost all medical settings where they need that constant attention. So it's a question for research. I mean, this is a great, and the work is just starting to get underway. If we improve the sleep of the seriously ill people, does it change outcomes? And so far, the information that we have is very encouraging, but I'd have to say that in terms of actual evidence, the kind of data on which health management decisions are made, I think that is still developing.
And Kim, do you have anything to add?
Well, just basically on what Dr. Twery was saying regarding critical care and hospitals and so forth, I know that many hospitals are starting to recognize that that the patients are going to heal a lot faster if they're allowed to have, a good resting period. It's not such a 24-hour type of environment. And so many of those hospitals will dim the lights down during the evening hours. Of course, there's no visitors and things like that. And they try to have the nursing staff just come in and attend to the patient if it's absolutely necessary. So we are moving forward a little bit regarding, these critical care patients. And that's pretty much all I can add on that.
Kim, I was just thinking maybe also we should mention that if you compare elderly homes and retirement community facilities, care facilities for, the hallways, the environments, those lives, that they exist today in those facilities is quite different from what was common 10 or 15 years ago when, during the day would be kept dim. And then the lights would be kept on all night.
Absolutely.
And now many retirement communities and homes, they adapt their, the lighting is adapted to help encourage.
Dr. Twery, on that note, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. We actually have a number of questions from listeners about lighting. And Andrea, again, thank you for calling and good luck with your situation. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. We have a free email newsletter. Join more than 7,000 of your fellow listeners who get an email every week or two that will keep you aware of the diverse programming on local public radio, as well as opportunities to participate in station events. Just click the email newsletter link on the homepage of KALW.org. And thank you for listening to and supporting your local public radio station, KALW, San Francisco.
is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing media coverage of Sudan, and we'll be talking about coverage of the millions of dollars being raised and spent on the presidential race. Next week, we're doing shows about fracking in California and what happens at SeaWorld. And I also wanted to mention that I'll be reading from my story about older homeless women in San Francisco Friday night at the Makeout Room in San Francisco at 7 o'clock. And you can find more information on the Your Call Facebook page. Today, we are talking about the importance of sleep and sleep deprivation. 40 to 50 million American adults sleep 6 or fewer hours a day, according to the CDC, which means that a lot of us are not getting enough sleep. We need about 7 to 8. And so many of us are sleep deprived. We know it, but we're just not doing the right or taking steps to go to bed earlier. And we've got full lines and so many emails. So clearly, a lot of people, this issue speaks to so many of you. We'll have an open line in just a couple minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Dr. Michael Twery, Director of the National Center on Sleep Disorders Research at the National Institutes of Health. Kimberly Trotter is Administrative Director of the UC San Francisco Sleep Disorders Center. And now I would like to welcome Dr. David Dinges to the show. Dr. Dinges is Professor of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania's School of Medicine and serves as Chief of the Division of Sleep and Chronobiology. Hi, Dr. Dinges. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
It's great to have you. So you focus on people who don't get enough sleep, but also who work throughout the night. You say that working the night shift is a carcinogen.
Well, I don't say it. The World Health Organization has declared night shift work as a carcinogen by virtue of epidemiologic studies indicating that there are elevated levels of breast and prostate cancer in night shift workers. Now, it cannot be said that we know for a fact that it is the night shift or the food that's available on the night shift or the circadian disruption or the sleep loss, but some individual or combination of factors is producing elevated risks on the night shift.
We actually have a number of questions about this. Susie writes, my daughter is at a boarding school where she sleeps in a dorm that has lights on at night. I've heard that sleeping in light may be linked with cancer. Can you talk more about this? And so we did a show about a year or two ago about the fact that it's hard to find darkness in our society now because we've got so much light. And I noticed just in my neighborhood, it's hard to find one spot that's very dark, especially near windows.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the irony of putting in light-emitting diodes, which are cheaper for municipalities to operate and last longer, they also produce a really potent light. And if the light is above your window in any way, even out in the street, you can produce a large amount of light in the bedroom. So we do have a light pollution problem, and it's one that not only affects cities. Most people are not aware it affects rural environments. It affects the behavior of animals in that when there's too much light, and even plants, potentially. Light is critical to the timing of the sleep-wake system and circadian biology in general. It's the number one synchronizer. It is a very powerful synchronizer. People are not aware that at night when they stay up late, that blue screen that they sometimes look at on the television or the computer can actually be telling their brain that it's daytime and trying to push the sleep later into the night. And if you're vulnerable to displacement of your sleep, difficulty sleeping, insomnia, and that, you have to be very careful about light exposure. I always say that, you know, you need enough light if you get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, whatever, but you don't want to expose yourself to bright light. You want to keep those lights off or low. You really want to make your bedroom a place that's dark as much as possible, and that includes darkening the electronic devices that are on. I know when I travel, my cell phone's on at night in the room, and I put a pillow or something, a cloth over it, because even the small lights on it are very bright.
And I'm sure so many of us are guilty of this. I know I am. I'm on the computer right before I go to bed, maybe until midnight. What is that doing to our bodies?
Well, we don't know that that harms us in any way, except that it can delay us from going to bed. It can get us aroused right? You get that email at the end of the day that's either very exciting or more likely, here's another work thing you have to take care of, or something that's disturbing from a friend about something that's happened to them. And then that further aggravates our ability to disconnect from the world, to calm ourselves, to reduce our stress reactions, and to allow ourselves to go to sleep. And that contributes to a lot of lifestyle type insomnia and problems of sleeping.
Well, we've got full lines, so let's go through a few callers. Let's hear from Catherine in Santa Cruz. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks so much. I always love your show.
Thank you.
I have a question. I don't think anybody talked about this. I didn't hear exactly everything on the show yet today, but I was wondering when you have to when you get older. I'm going to be 60 this year, and I have to get up once a night, once in a while, twice a night, and I'm wondering if you know, to go into the bathroom. And I'm wondering, I know that you have to sleep around 6 hours to have the deep REM sleep kick in, and I just wondered, you know, how does that mess with your sleep?
Dr. Tweri, do you want to take that? I've read that if you have to go to the bathroom, you should have a red light, because if you have the normal yellow light, that really affects your melatonin production.
Well, so just as Dr. Din just said a moment ago, I mean, it doesn't help your sleep. It doesn't help the patterning of a rhythm, because the light affects our communicates with our eyes, and it signals our brain that, gee, it's like a daytime out here. But you don't want to be in such a dark environment as you move about your room that you're going to trip and fall, particularly as we get older. But you know, getting up briefly, staying in dim light, and going back to bed, is not entirely unusual. If this is a new symptom, that, you know, something that is you know, becoming a burden to you, or if you find that in conjunction with having to get up and go to the bathroom several times a night, that you feel that you're sleepier or less restored during the day, less refreshed by your sleep, you might want to discuss these symptoms with your physician, because these are developments are sometimes indications of other medical conditions, or sometimes sleep disorders, which your physician is in the best position to know, you know, how to pursue it and whether to treat it.
These things can, you know, the nocturia, the need to to relieve yourself in the middle of the night, increases with age, with changes physiologically in our bodies. But also, people need to be aware that you might want to, you know, reduce the amount you're drinking before bed. Of tea or water, whatever it is. You get a little older and you find out that actually drinking that large mug of tea before bed, which is very calming and relaxing, and you always do it, now sends you to the bathroom more often. And so part of this is being mindful, being mindful of what promotes your sleep and what interferes with your sleep, and what can you do in your life, your behavior, that will help you.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Catherine. And let's hear next from Doug in San Francisco. Hi, Doug.
Hi. You talked earlier about as we get older that our sleep pattern changes, get sleepy earlier, wake up in the early morning and have difficulty getting back to sleep. How about on the other end, teenagers? I've heard that we rather tyrannically enforce school hours to the convenience of adults, when in fact teenagers would normally want to go to bed much, much later and wake up much, much later. So they're not at their best when they're in school. Can you make any comments?
All right. Thank you. Who'd like to take that one?
I'll take that one. This is actually a fairly serious cultural problem in the United States and other cultures. Right at a time when the developing brain needs still a great deal of sleep, and the studies suggest that the average adolescent in high school and even younger college students need up to 9 hours a night, we're waking them up earlier and earlier to get them to school because of the logistics and the contracts around busing and the number of buses available and contracts regarding teachers and school systems, so that they end up at night then. There's a natural biological tendency for adolescents to stay up later and to separate from their parents, in a sense, And the net result is they're up late and then they're up early. They develop terrific cumulative sleep debts. This has an unequivocally clear impact on their ability to be alert, attentive, to remember and perform well in school. Add to that extracurricular activities and other things, and sleep becomes the one area where adolescents are in greatest deficit. And if there's a single thing we could do that would make a fundamental difference and possibly change a generation's view of the value of sleep for health and safety, would be to allow adolescents to get the sleep they need rather than sleep depriving them for seemingly good intentions, but actually producing what are very disturbing results, including their tendency towards impulsive behavior, risk-taking, and falling asleep while driving.
All right. Well, thank you for the question, Doug. We also have a question from another parent. Alexander says, what do parents of infants do when they may go months without good quality sleep? How does that impact health?
Well, the chronic disturbance of sleep caring for a new baby is something that has not been extensively studied, but models of chronic sleep restriction over time in the laboratory show that there are cumulative deficits. Many women and men, especially women who've cared for babies, their children, will say that ever since they had a child, they've never been able to fully sleep as long in the morning, or they wake up prematurely. And we don't really understand scientifically what has happened, but we do know from the laboratory studies of chronic sleep restriction that it does look like there are longer-term effects on the brain from chronic restriction of sleep than we appreciated or thought existed in the past.
You know, Rose, I'd like to add to what Dr. Dingers was saying there, but, you know, everything we mentioned earlier that goes with acute sleep deprivation, that it affects our mood, it affects our emotional regulation. You know, I think parents need to be aware that this is a natural, consequence of meeting their parental duties 24 hours a day. And I think maybe hopefully being aware that this is a problem will sensitize them to when these problems may be affecting them, and hopefully prevent other complications in terms of family relationships and otherwise.
It's a good reason why I would add that it's important for new parents to, before they have the baby, learn about, and there are books on this and articles, self-help things, to help them encourage the baby to sleep through the night as soon as that is developmentally possible, so that while it's going to be a challenge for a number of months, not to drag that chronic sleep restriction and awakening in the middle of the night into the second and third year of life, because it's not necessary that happen.
And Kim, what are your thoughts on this? Just thinking about these issues and the focus on women and just sort of the role that they play. There was an article in The Atlantic called Women Still Can't Have It All by Anne-Marie Slaughter. And I was just thinking that there's connections to this where you're talking about working and taking care of children and, you know, keeping the house up. But sleep never plays into that. How can you bring get this issue a little more attention?
Well, you have to bring the whole family into the situation, and the nice thing is things are changing slowly but surely. We do have actually a lot of husbands or fathers that are staying home with the children rather than the mothers. So we are starting to see a little bit of a change in that aspect. And we're also seeing parents equally helping out with the children and with the housework and everything else. You know, most families these days, you know, both parents are working. And so, you know, even though the mother is considered or the wife is considered to take care of a lot of things, things are definitely changing for the better.
And are doctors, is the medical industry dealing with sleep as a public health issue?
I would say more and more, but not enough yet. In some professions, definitely. Certainly sleep medicine specialists are, and there are many subspecialties where you can specialize in sleep medicine, psychiatry, neurology, internal medicine. But more and more, I think, the primary care world is beginning to understand the value of sleep, but it's not nearly as integrated into healthcare and prevention as it should be.
So I think this is a great example of where the ongoing research, whether it's done in, you know, the research being done by Dr. Gingis and his colleagues and at many universities throughout the country are going to make that possible. Because, you know, for physicians or for individuals in your audience, you know, having the information is the first step in that direction. We have a study going, you mentioned newborn children a moment ago and their parents. We have a study going on right now observing the sleep of 10,000 women have in their first pregnancy, and we're going, the purpose of the study is to understand how their sleep during the pregnancy is affecting maternal health and how it affects the delivery of these children.
And that is,
I might also add that there's a lot more public awareness in sleep, which is also helping to drive those primary care physicians to pay a little bit more attention to the sleep problems as well.
And that is Kimberly Trotter. She's Administrative Director of the UC San Francisco Sleep Disorders Center. Dr. Michael Twary is Director of the National Center on Sleep Disorders Research at the National Institutes of Health. And Dr. David Dingis is Professor of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He's Editor-in-Chief of Sleep, the leading scientific journal on sleep research and sleep medicine. And we have just under 10 minutes left, and if you'd like to join us, we've got full lines. We'll have a line open in just a couple minutes, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org, and we'll try to get to as many of you as possible. Let's go next to Ted in San Francisco. Hi, Ted.
Hi. So I know when I get a cold or the flu, I tend to sleep like 12 to 14 hours, something like that. And I was just wondering if there's been research that shows that amount of sleep, or that, you know, allowing yourself to sleep as much as you can shortens the length of your cold or flu. Also, just about trying to figure out how much sleep you need normally, I would think it would be healthy maybe if you have 2 or 3 days where you don't have a lot going on to just sort of allow yourself to go to sleep when you're tired and not set an alarm and wake up when you awake, and I would think that would be a good way to figure out how much sleep you need normally.
And Ted, do you ever get sick after not getting enough sleep?
Well, I'm one of those people who just gets a lot of sleep. I sleep 9 to 10 hours
a
night.
Wow. That is a lot. Is that how much you need? Do you think?
I think so, yeah. I pretty much just allow myself to wake up when I need to wake up and try not to use the alarm too much.
Wow, lucky you.
I would say that the incredulity in your voice illustrates beautifully how Americans perceive sleep. They're almost shocked when someone reports that they're a healthy person who sleeps a healthy, large amount of sleep, that it's somehow like not American to do that, or you must
Absolutely.
Be sick. And it illustrates beautifully this sort of reflexive bias we have that if you sleep a lot, you have to be, there has to be something wrong with you.
Hmm.
And I think the caller really nicely illustrates, those questions are perfectly appropriate too. There are cytokine and other biological responses that occur when we get an inflammation and illness that make us lethargic and will promote sleep, but they don't necessarily promote the sleep as much as they knock us down and we just don't want to get up. So we'll lie in bed or find it's painful to move, etc. But the reverse is true. There are increasing number of studies showing that sleep deprivation reduces our ability to resist viruses and infection. It blunts the benefits of a vaccine to a pathogen. And many people will tell you after they travel and go through jet lag, they don't get sick during the jet lag. They get sick afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's more we need to understand about it, but there's no question that the sleep system, inadequate sleep, and circadian displacement can affect immunologic responses, and we showed that some years ago in a study. As to how much sleep you need, we study this a great deal in the lab, and I have to tell you that almost the vast majority of people usually need more than they're getting. The real question that the caller asked that's so important scientifically is, why do I need to recover? Is it, you know, should I take 3 or 4 days when I don't have anything and turn my alarm off, which is an artificial way of awakening? And by the way, when we awaken to the alarm, many of us drink coffee, a drug. It is a drug. It's an adenosine-binding drug that blocks the sleep inertia. So we create an illusion in our brain that we've slept enough, when in fact the brain wants to sleep more, but the drug blocks it. And that's why caffeine's consumed in the morning, ironically, heavily, right after sleep, which is odd, right? You sleep and then you take a stimulant.
Well, we have an email about this, actually. How do coffee or these energy drinks keep us awake, and how do they change our bodies if we drink them over and over again?
Well, it's the caffeine that is the potent stimulant. It's the most widely consumed stimulant in the world. And while it is, for most people, relatively safe, neither caffeine nor any other drug we know of is a substitute for sleep. In other words, you cannot use the drug or the stimulant to trick the brain into biologically believing it slept. All you're doing is activating arousal systems to force the wakefulness. But it'll run out of gas. Once the sleep debt is too high, the sleep pressure is too great from inadequate sleep, even the caffeine won't block it.
We also have a question from Chuck, who says, what about, well, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but he writes, ironically, I've been struggling with sleep since the most recent schedule change. I love your call, but the subject matter does not lend itself to relaxation during your 11 o'clock rebroadcast on KALW. This show is rebroadcast at 11 o'clock, and the topics can often be pretty heavy. So you might be listening to a show about homelessness or poverty or war at 11 o'clock at night, right before going to bed.
Well, not very good sleep hygiene.
No, I think that the recommendation is always we want to encourage a regular sleep time, a rhythm of sleep and wakefulness, so that you go to sleep at about the same time each night. You sleep we recommend 7 to 8 hours. For some people, it might be a bit more. For adolescents, it's certainly more. And then we recommend that, you know, that your quality of sleep is important to this process, too. And Dr. Dinges can perhaps explain more, but, you know, this pattern that we discussed earlier where we sleep one, you know, we use one schedule during the work week. We wake up at 5 a.m. and, you know, maybe stay up later. And then on weekends, we switch to a different schedule. This switching in timing is a challenge. It's a stress to our, how the regulation of these rhythms work, and it confuses them.
It's called social jet lag by some of our colleagues in Europe, but our studies of the Americans use time, Matthias Basner, my colleague, has looked at about 50,000 Americans. He has another database of 100,000. And we, instead of using sunrise and sunset to tell us biologically when to sleep, which is historically where we come from as humans in terms of our past, we use alarm clocks to wake us, and we use primetime television to tell us when to go to bed. And these are social triggers. And then, as Michael said, we're squeezing our sleep in the week and expanding on the weekend sometimes. The net result is that we have both the timing and the duration disturbed. And that combination is a very problematic combination. If you have a fragile sleep system, or if you're vulnerable to some of the biological and behavioral effects of poor sleep, behavioral effects can include being overly emotional or not reading emotions correctly, in addition to the cognitive effects, having trouble with attention, remembering, etc.
And just quickly, how have our sleep patterns changed over the years?
Well, no one is entirely sure, because scientists often don't trust the anecdotes of history. On the other hand, it's pretty clear that humans now use time like a commodity, the most precious of commodity. We have hundreds of millions of people worldwide on night shift. Mm. We have people transiting time zones by the hundreds of millions constantly. The net result is our sleep is squeezed down to probably as low as it's ever been, in order to try and accommodate this terrific demand on multitasking and wake time, which we're doing all the time, and we're doing it right now, and the transit. And what the data show from the timing studies are, Americans will trade sleep for two things dominantly. Number one is paid work, and number two is travel time, and that includes commute time.
Mm.
And those cut into sleep.
And we have a few more emails about how getting up in the middle of the night interrupts REM sleep.
Well, so one kind of sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, is occurring in a phase sequence alternating with non-REM, and it's really... It isn't so much the disruption of REM sleep, it's the disruption of the continuity of sleep that Dr. Turi was talking about earlier that is so problematic. It's produced by some disorders, medical disorders, but it's also produced by some lifestyle factors. And it can make it hard to go back to sleep, and fragmenting sleep repeatedly, as occurs with obstructive sleep apnea, actually markedly reduces the recovery benefit of sleep.
Well, we've got about a minute left, so each of you 30 seconds. Final thoughts on the importance of sleep, Dr. Twery?
Yeah, so I think that we would like to for your audience to take back the message that they need to, that sleep is part of the background, along with diet and exercise, is part of that background that is necessary for us as individuals to achieve our best health possible. And we need to take advantage of the opportunity for sleep when it's, because it's important and value it along with other things. And by sleep, as we've said throughout this program, we're talking about the timing of sleep, the duration of sleep, and the quality of sleep.
Thank you. And Kimberly?
Well, I'd like to leave the audience with a few sleep hygiene rules and some things that will help you to get a better night's sleep in the evening, hopefully a little bit earlier than what you may have been getting to bed, currently. And that is, just make sure that you have some kind of a pre-bedtime ritual to where, you know, you're not watching the news. That's not the last thing that you're seeing before you go to bed. You're not on your computer. You don't have your TV in your bedroom. Do some reading, some yoga, something like that. Take a bath. And then when you get to bed, turn your alarm clock around to where if you do wake up in the middle of the night, that's not the first thing that you're looking at, because what are you doing? You're doing math.
Right.
How many hours before I have to go to, before I have to get up?
All right. Well, good tips. I will try to do that tonight. Thank you so much. Kimberly Trotter is with the UC San Francisco Sleep Disorder Center. Dr. Michael Twery is with the National Institutes of Health. And Dr. David Dingus is with the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for your many phone calls and emails. It's your call. Thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the millions of dollars being raised and spent on the presidential campaign. How are political ads being covered? We'll also discuss coverage of the ongoing protests in Sudan. We'll be joined by ProPublica's Justin Elliott, Politico's Dave Leventhal, and Bloomberg's Salma Al-Wardani joins us from Cairo. She was just kicked out of Sudan. Where did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. We'll be right back.